just want to begin with a couple brief words of introduction as folks are coming in. And I know we always have folks who are joining us as we go here who haven't been here for past couple sessions. So good to see everyone and welcome everyone. I just want to say here it's 8:02 and I'm sitting here in my dining room in the northwest corner of New York City, but nonetheless a curfew has begun here, which is kind of a mind-blowing thing and not something I think anyone imagined would be happening. And there's just so much that is broken and scary and upside down right now. I think it's always extremely powerful when the Torah that you're learning as just kind of part of an ongoing commitment to being someone who studies Torah, to being a practicing Jew, ends up colliding, even if only partially, with contemporary events. And it's incredibly powerful and incredibly sad that really the key pasuk that we began this whole chapter with is Mishpat Echad Yihyeh Lachem, you know, the basic claim that the Torah makes that the processes of justice must be uniform across everyone. We talked about how that's used in the Midrashim and in our chapter to ultimately milk out a kind of consistency of procedure across both civil and criminal lines that builds on the fact that the Torah says this more than once. That is to say, there's more than one occurrence of the phrase, Mishpat Echad Yihyeh Lachem. So it must be coming to teach something beyond the basic point of the equality of the subjects of the law to the consistency of the procedure of the law, irrespective of what kind of law is being dealt with. But as our sages said, Ein mikra yotze midei pshuto, the plain sense is never lost. And it's important, I think, to remember that the Torah sometimes repeats things because even the most obvious things need repeating. And in this case, repeating the basic notion that everybody, and in the Torah it's emphasized, right, even non-Israelites, even people who you might have some thought of, well, they're not really a citizen, but certainly everyone who is a citizen and who shares a land is to be treated exactly the same as far as the law goes. And the ways in which that is just an obvious corollary of the narrative basis for this whole system of the Torah, which begins with a single human being who is the ancestor of all, and therefore it's impossible to imagine that different people are different. So I don't know if it's even appropriate to sort of talk about dedicating learning in memory of, in spirit of what's going on. It feels sort of trivial to the task, though I would say, I hope you will keep that principle in mind as we get deeper into this. And the sense that we've been dealing with mostly through procedural pieces, but that really is about how do we take lives, right? How do we imagine we take lives? And, you know, I want to just say one more thing about that, which is we've had a number of back and forths about how much of this is real. And how much of this is imagined? How much did anyone ever get executed under this system? And how much is this about Chazal in one way or another kind of talking out, well, this is what we imagine it would be. And while that's important historically, certainly, and it's important as we've seen often textually to kind of understand what's going on, you know, I would add that the difference between something being real and something being imagined in terms of its effect on society is not often as big as we might think. That is to say, the way in which people imagine the wheels of justice will or won't turn ends up affecting in deep ways actually how people behave. If you talk about holding people accountable for certain things, you create a culture of a certain degree of accountability. If you talk about human lives being valued differently, even if you're not carrying that out, you create a certain kind of reality. I was brought back this week to when I took Afro-American Studies 10 with Cornel West as an undergraduate, and we read the novel Native Son, and the ways in which really the whole main plot twist in the book turns on what the tragic protagonist there sort of imagines will happen if he's discovered in the bedroom of a white woman. That leads him to make a whole series of horrendous and, you know, morally impossible and unacceptable decisions. But that was really about what was sort of the construct and the assumption of what would happen before it even happened. So I think the business of talking about the values of how people are executed, what judicial procedures do or don't do in the world, even when it's not clear how much we're talking in real time and projecting some notion of here's what the rabbis, here's what we as the heirs to the rabbinic tradition think we could or should be talking about, strikes me as uncomfortably real and present in the contemporary moment. So I'll just invite us by way of, I don't think we can ignore kind of where we are, and I can't ignore the fact that it would be illegal for me to leave my apartment right now. Just bring some of that kavanah and that's, some of that intention to our learning. So thanks for being here and continuing our commitment to this even during, and maybe especially during these difficult times. So I want to pick up just sort of with the last little piece we did last time, which was kind of a midrashic piece about the power of Torah. It is kind of a rich set of metaphors that was grounded in a little bit of grammar, and just finish kind of playing that piece out. And then we'll move into what's basically the second part of our sugya that we've been in the middle of, which mostly has been focusing on when do people get to back out of their vote on the court, potentially to eventually vote for a conviction. And you'll recall, we ended that section with a kind of rumination on the question of, can the Torah produce multiple truths out of one verse, one compact set of verbiage? And as a sort of complementary question, is it possible for multiple verses in the Torah to lead you to the same truth? And our answer was basically yes and no, right? That is to say that there is fundamentally this sort of multiplicity power to Torah, which is all about, you know, having the Torah almost infinitely spread out in terms of meaning. But it's not possible to imagine that multiple pieces of the Torah would simply produce the same elements. So I'm going to put up here again just to sort of remind us where we were, and then I want to take us to something off the page here so we can see that again with a little more dimension. So we were up here, we were, if you recall, going through this thing of why would we write down Divrei HaMizakin? Why would we write down the words of those who voted to acquit unless they had the possibility of reversing themselves? We wanted to use that as a proof for the fact that when it gets to the Gmar Din, the final stage, even though during the deliberation, you can't switch from being a Mizakeh to a Michayev, from someone who's acquitting to someone who's convicting, this would seem to indicate that there is some stage where you can switch and vote to convict after having argued for acquittal, because otherwise why would we put down your vote for acquittal unless we wanted to have a record and say, hey, you're not allowed to vote that way, you can't switch. And we dismissed that by saying, no, it's Kedesh lo yomru shnayim tam echad mishne mikraot, so that there would not be two people trying to argue for the same basis of acquittal. And here again, this seems to be to do with, you know, not the facts, but sort of the arguments of law as to whether there should be a conviction or an acquittal in this case. And that's the reason we need to keep track of it. Not because the person necessarily can reverse themselves, but because they can We do have to keep track that we don't have multiple votes basically coming for the same conclusion from multiple verses, okay? And then we asked Menahem Emile, how do we know that? Where does that come from? And we got Abaye talking about this verse, Achati Ber Elohim Shtayim Zu Shamati, and then we got this statement from Devei Rabbi Ishmael, Uchefatish Yefotzetz Sela. Ma patish ze mitchalek lechama nitzotzot, af mikra achad yotzei lekama tamim. And the debate, if you recall, was sort of what's being smashed? What's turning into smithereens? And I just want us to kind of appreciate where this is coming from and what makes it possible, which is really a deeper grammar piece. So these are two psukim that just illustrate something that we kind of take for granted in English, that unless you're speaking in some sort of, you know, Yoda Star Wars dialect of English, pretty much you put the subject followed by the verb as a way of explaining what you're talking about. But other languages do not have that. Do not have that limitation. Some are very pronounced in that regard. Russian definitely doesn't have that. And even though Hebrew is certainly modern Hebrew as a convention of saying, like, you know, ani holech lachanut, okay, as opposed to holech ani lachanut, I am walking to the store, as opposed to walk I to the store, there is, in fact, license to read it a different way. And you see that in the Tanakh itself. So this pasuk from Yeshayahu, apesel nasach harash, so pesel is a noun, that's an idol, and harash is a smith or, you know, a woodworker here, like it's someone who is fashioning the object. So here, right, nasach indicates we're dealing with a metal object, that is to say, like a nesech, where you pour something. We're talking about a craftsman pouring molten material into a mold to make an idol. The pesel, the idol, is not pouring out a smith, right? That is to say, the obvious meaning of this pasuk is the idol was poured out, or, you know, was put into the mold by the smith. And yet the smith comes last. Okay, so you can say the smith poured out the idol by saying HaPesel Nasach HaRash. Or another striking verse from Iyov, Avanim Shachaku Mayim. So Avanim are stones, Mayim is water. Shachaku means to wear away. Stones are obviously not wearing away water. Water is wearing away stones. And yet the water is second in the pasuk. Okay, why is that all significant? Well, it's highly significant because if I say instead of this, kifatish yifotzet sela, the question is what's the subject and what's the object? I can read this pasuk syntactically either as just as a hammer will shatter a rock, or I can read it just as a rock will shatter a hammer. Both of those are completely legitimate syntactical readings of the biblical verse. And therefore, back in our sugya, when we are debating and trying to understand what's going on with this pasuk, which I'll put back up in the Talmudic context, the argument between basically Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam that we saw last time, where Rashi is arguing that it is, or it was Rashbam, sorry, in the Tosafot. Rashbam is suggesting that it is the hammer that is smashing the rock. And Rabbeinu Tam is suggesting, no, it is the solid, immovable material of the rock, which makes the hammer, you know, split into two or give off sparks, different ways of understanding that. They're actually having a debate of what's the right reading of the verse. I'll introduce just one other thing which we didn't see last time, which I think is pretty amazing, which is the Maharsha, who's one of the early modern commentators, in particular on the Agadic sections of the Gemara. So he reads Sela here. He says, Sela here should be understood not as rock, But in the rabbinic usage of it as a coin, a sela is a denomination of currency. And therefore, chifatishi fotzet sela, the Maharshal wants to read as, just as a hammer bangs out a coin anew, so too the power of Torah is that it can refashion basically a corrupted human being into a newly minted identity that has regained its form. And that, I think, is then a very powerful way of thinking about three different images of Torah. Torah is either the all-powerful hammer that comes in and can smash anything in its way. It is the sort of eternal thing that no matter how hard you hit it, will not break. Or it is a tool for kind of refashioning and remaking people. And that all depends on how you read subject and object and how you read what this sela is, basically, that is being discussed in one way or the other. Okay, great. So we've got, I think, some interesting pieces there. And now we're ready to go on, where the Gemara is going to now ask, Heichi dami tam echad mishnei mikraot. So just how do we get a case of one reason that comes from two sources? Okay. And what's a concrete case we can talk about where we can potentially see that, where we want to avoid it? And we're now going to get in the final tally of who's voting for what in these kinds of cases. So now we're going to get what really is going to be sort of totally off topic. This is like a sort of second order dragnet for cases, though it's not a very wide dragnet. You're going to see it all kind of comes from one place, cases where it could be that we are grounding the same idea in multiple verses. And we're going to have statements by Rav Zvid, Rav Papa, and Rav Ashi trying to find versions of this. All right, so, but I got to take you to one other thing to kind of get us to understand it, and then the Gemara will work a little better. Okay, so this, what we're going to get into here, what the Gemara is going to engage, is basically the question of when something goes up onto the Mizbeach, onto the altar, and it shouldn't be up there, when do you say, oh, that thing has got to come down? And when do you say, it's already up there, we let it go? Sort of the discussion here at its core is actually a fascinating larger discussion of like, when do you let mistakes slide? And when do you say, no, can't let that happen? I'll give you an interesting example from Shul and gender politics, which comes out of this in a minute. Okay, so there are the verses we need to focus on are these. In Shmot Kaf Tet, there is a statement, kind of cryptic and maybe overbroad statement, Kol HaNogea BaMizbeach Yikdash. Anything that touches the Mizbeach will become holy. Not clear exactly what the scope of that is, but taken broadly, that could mean something like, as soon as something comes anywhere near the Mizbeach, like whether it was supposed to be there or not, it's completely sacred. That passage then goes on to describe the Olat HaTamid and saying, now that you've built the Mizbeach, because this is in the context of building the Mishkan, now that you've built the Mizbeach, this is what you need to do on it consistently, two lambs every day. This is the Olat Tamid Ledorotechem. This is the daily continual offering that you've always got to make sure to bring. I highlighted the words Kvasim and Olat. You'll see in a moment why. Another verse relevant to our discussion is from the beginning of Parshat Tzav, sixth chapter of Vayikra. Tzav et Aharon ve'banav le'mor, zot Torat ha'olah. Here are the rules of the Olah. And then a kind of repeating phrase, Hi ha'olah. It is the Olah. A little weird. What do you mean? Zot Torat ha'olah. This is the rules of the Olah. It is the Olah. Sounds like and will be taken as a cue of, yeah, this is the rule of the Olah. If that thing goes up there, it's considered an Olah. That is to say, even if it's not exactly how you expected, I'm telling you that thing is an Olah. And then added phrasing here, which will be important, Al Mokda Al Hamizbeach. On the fire, on the Mizbeach. These verses are going to be used for a four-way debate among the Tanaim of the generations of Rabbi Yoshua and Rabbi Akiva, broadly speaking, as to how we deal with basically mistakes that happened in the context of the Mizbeach. All right, so I wanted to take you through this Sifra, which will save us a lot of time in the Gemara, but so you see first what this basic debate is about. Okay, so the Sifra, the early Midrash Halacha on Vayikra, says the following. Rabbi Yose Aglili Omer, Mitoch she'nemar kol anogea b'mizbeach yikdash, shomea ani dvarim ha'reuyim l'mizbeach, udvarim she'enam reuyim l'mizbeach? Given that I have this overbroad statement that anything that touches the Mizbeach becomes holy, can I conclude from that 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 means everything? Like even something that's not ra'uy l'mizbeach? Like what if a pig is brought up on the altar? It's like, well, then you got to burn it. What if a chair is brought up on the altar? Then you got to burn it. What are the limits of this principle called Nogea b'mizbeach yikdash? Talmud lomar, the Torah specifies and thereby clarifies, kvasim. In the very next verse, it says, what's the ola? The ola is lambs. Ma kvasim, ha-miyuchadim, she'en re'uyim la-mizbeach, yatsa davar she'en re'uy la-mizbeach. From the fact that we immediately move from the broad statement of anything that touches the Mizbeach is holy to a specification of bringing lambs, we can understand that the kol, the anything that goes up, is something that you would be commanded to be brought as a sacrifice. So maybe you're bringing it at the wrong time, maybe it's the wrong kind, but as long, it's got to be a thing that you would offer as a korban. All right? That's Rabbi Yose Aglili. Rabbi Akiva Omer. Mitoch she'nemar kol anogea b'mizbeach yikdash, shomea ani dvarim ha'reuyim l'mizbeach udvarim she'enam reuyim l'mizbeach. Same question, same possibility. But here, Talmud lomar ola. The Torah says, an ola. It uses that word. He may mean olat tamid here in that following verse. He may also be hyperlinking to the midbar, where we say shnayim layom, not like here, it says shnayim layom tamid, but it says shnayim layom ola tamid there, and Rabbi Akiva may just be doing the switch in his head and saying the word ola is in there. Ma ola miyuchedet shehi reuya lamizbeach, av kol davar sheraui lamizbeach, yatsa davar she'en raui lamizbeach. Rabbi Akiva basically says, I'm not learning it from kvasim, I'm learning it from ola. Now you should hear right here, just before you know we get back into our sugya, we're going to do a little more here, but you should hear, it sounds like Rabbi Yose Aglili and Rabbi Akiva reach the exact same conclusion, just from a different particle, as it were, from a different way of reading the text. One zeroes in on the word kvasim, and one zeroes in on the word ola, all right? But fundamentally, they are getting to the same conclusion. So if we were looking for ta'am echad, mishnei mikraot, you could imagine someone alighting on this debate. Let's just finish off the other two views. Rabbi Yoshua Omer, kol ra'ui la'ishim im ala lo yered. He wants to articulate a principle a little different. If it is worthy of being burned in fire, then if it goes up, it does not come down. How do we know that? He ha'ola al-mokda. Focusing on that other verse from Vayikra, where al-mokda, on the flame, is mentioned. Rabbi Yeshua understands that verse to indicate, he ha'ola, it is an ola, it is something that should go up in smoke, al-mokda, provided that it is fundamentally something that would be burned. Ma'ola shehi ruya la'ishim im alta lo tered, kach kol davar shehi ruya la'ishim im alta lo tered. Okay? So if a pig would never ever be burned, okay? Or if the meat of a chatat offering would never be burned, it would always be eaten by the kohanim, so it doesn't go up because it doesn't count as mukda. And Rabban Gamliel then comes in and says, "Hi aola al mokda al mizbeach, ma aola shehi reuya la mizbeach im alta lo tered, kach kol davar shereuya la mizbeach im ala lo yered." Hi aola, this is something that's got to go up and stay up, but al mokda al hamizbeach, provided that it is something that should go up to the Mizbeach, and therefore if it went up, it should not come down. Similarly, anything that could be offered on the Mizbeach, if it went up, it shouldn't go down. Now, before we get to the last passage in the Sifra, I want to just emphasize, you could read all four of these views as not arguing about a matter of law at all. There are four different ways of deriving the principle of something that's ra'ui la mizbeach shouldn't come down, even if it went up there mistakenly. What's an example of this? For instance, you have an ola, it's an animal that was designated to be completely burned, but it got disqualified somewhere along the way. Or maybe it became tameh, it became impure. But it is fundamentally kind of valid to be burned. So you go ahead and burn it once it was taken up. It was a mistake, but kol hanogea b'mizbeach yikdash, all right? And you could read this as four views that are not arguing law, they're only arguing source of law. That gets a little mucked with when we get to the final piece here, where the text says, Ein bein divrei Rabban Gamliel ledivrei Rabbi Yoshua ela hadam ve'anesachim. There's no practical disagreement between Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua other than blood and libations. Sherabban Gamliel omer lo yerdu v'Rabbi Yoshua omer yerdu. Why are those different? Because blood and libations are things that are brought to the altar but are not burned. And therefore, if you think Rabbi Yoshua's formulation of hara'ui la'ishim, appropriate for fire, is not just a way of talking about something being appropriate for the altar, but specifically appropriate to be burned, it could be he actually has a smaller scope of things where you turn the other way once something went up on the altar that shouldn't have been there. And for the purposes of our sugya, what's important is once the voice in the Sifra distinguishes between Rabbi Yoshua and Rabban Gamliel and assumes that their divergent derivations imply divergent legal conclusions, that opens up the possibility that the same might be true for Rabbi Yosei Aglili and Rabbi Akiva. Okay, so let me just pause there if there's just any questions on the technical piece there, because what we're really going to do now is full speed see how the Gemara uses that for our purposes, which is, okay, what would be a good example of ta'am echad mishnei mikraot? And I'm going to leave that untranslated right now because I actually think the different Amoraim were probably understanding it in slightly different ways. Okay? Any comments, thoughts, questions, clarifications, feel free to chat it in as you digest it. I'm going to switch us back to the Talmudic text, and we're going to follow what happens there. Okay, so here we go. Hechi dame ta'am echad mishnei mikraot. So what is actually a case of one reason or one idea in some way that comes out of two verses. Amar Rav Zvid said, Kiditnan, and he's going to quote a Mishnah version of what we just saw. Mizbeach mekadesh et hara'uilo. The Mizbeach sanctifies that which is appropriate for it. Rabbi Yoshua omer, kol hara'uila ishim imala lo yered. Rabbi Yoshua says, anything that's appropriate for fire, if it goes up, it should not come down. Shenemar ha'ola, al-mokda. The key phrase being al-mokda, on the fire. Ma'ola, shehi ri'uya la'ishim, imalta lo tered, af koshu ra'u la'ishim, imala lo yered. Just as an ola is something that is burned, so too anything that would be burned, once it goes up on the mizbeach, doesn't come down. Rabban Gamliel omer, kol ha'ra'ui la'mizbeach, imala lo yered, shenemar hi ha'ola al-mokda al-ha'mizbeach. Ma'ola shehi ri'uya l'gabei mizbeach, im alta lo tered, av kol shehu ra'ui la'mizbeach, imala lo yered. All right, that's that debate we just saw. V'tarvayu, says the Gemara, mai kamarbu, psulin. Mar maitila mimokda, umar maitila mimizbeach. Both of them, says Rav Zvid, or someone in the name of Rav Zvid, are using their derivations to include in the principle of kol anogea b'mizbeach yikdash or im ala lo yered, psulin, things that are somehow got invalidated as sacrifices, should not have been offered, but they went up there. And one of them derives this from the word mokda, and one of them derives it from the word mizbeach. Great, that seems like it's a great example of the same principle being suggested from two different places. And now the Gemara is going to undermine that. Veha hatam miflag pliki. But it's not really ta'am echad. They don't really have the exact same law because they disagree there. It's not just two different derivations for the same law, it's two different derivations that have corollary differences to them. Dekatane seifa, ein bein divrei Rabban Gamliel divrei Rabbi Yoshua ela adam ve'anasachim. Because there's a later appendage to that text that says, no, they don't disagree much, but they do disagree on blood and libations. Sh'Rabban Gamliel omer lo yerdu v'Rabbi Yoshua omer yerdu. And therefore, ela amar Rav Papa. Therefore, Rav Papa is going to give a different debate, different case that will be more convincing in terms of providing actually the same ta'am, the same kind of, you know, legal point of law, but from two different things. I'm going to leave you, we'll see in a minute, I'm going to ask you whether you think these are different. Ela amar Rav Papa, kidetanya. We can learn this from a braita, and here we're going to quote our text. Rabbi Yose Aglili omer, mitoch shenemar, kol hanogea b'mizbeach yikdash, shomea ani bein ra'ui ben sheino ra'ui, Talmud lomar kvasim, makvasim ru'in af kol ra'ui. From the fact that it says anything that touches the mizbeach is holy, I might conclude even things that are not appropriate for the mizbeach. The Torah says kvasim, lambs, just as lambs are appropriate, we're only talking about something that's appropriate. That's the only kind of thing that is irreversibly up there, even if brought up by mistake. Rabbi Akiva omer, ola, ma ola re'uya, af kol ra'ui. Just that debate that we saw in that earlier text between Rabbi Yose Aglili and Rabbi Akiva. And now says the Gemara, v'tarvayu mai kamem ma'atu, psule. And what are both of them trying to limit? Things that are psulim, things that are inappropriate to be brought up to the mizbeach. Mar maiti la mikvasim, umar maiti la meola. And one of them is just deriving that principle from lambs, which are appropriate to be brought up, and one from ola, which is appropriate to be brought up. Okay, so that seems like it's better because they don't necessarily have a practical difference between them. They both agree it's just ra'ui and not ra'ui, and it's just what word gets us there. But then says the Gemara, v'ha'amar avada barava, olat ha'of psula ika beinayhu. No. The Amora Ravada Barava said, actually, this debate is not just about what word or phrase to derive it from. It is about the fact that that derivation has at stake whether what happens when an olat ha'of, that is psula, goes up on the altar. When there is an ola, a bird that was supposed to be completely burned on the altar, but it got messed up, it got disqualified. They think differently. Ika beinayu, this is actually a basis of disagreement between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yose Aglili. Man de maiti la mikvasim, kvasim in, aval olata of lo. Uman de maiti la meola, afilu olata of nami. So actually, the derivation matters because if you say lambs, then perhaps it's only lambs, it's only quadrupeds, it's only mammals, and birds do not get a free pass when they are brought up there inappropriately. Whereas Rabbi Akiva, who says ola, okay, when he says ola, he intends to be broad, okay? So that then undermines this, and I'll come back to some of the Rashis in a second. That undermines using this as, again, what we ideally want, which is Ta'am Echad, really being understood here by the Gemara as one ruling that is derived from two different things, because if we accept Rav Ada Bar Ava's gloss on that Braita, it's not one ruling. It's two derivations producing two conflicting rulings. Okay, so we have to replace it again. Ela Amar Rav Ashi. So Rav Ashi comes in with yet another derivation, okay? And says, Kiditanya, no, you got to take the example that we find in this next Braita, which says the following. Dam yechashev laishahu dam shafach. So this is a phrase from Vayikra Yud Zayin, chapter 17, which is talking about what Chazal referred to as shochetu ma'ale b'chutz, which is someone who slaughters or actually offers up, burns up an animal for sacrificial purposes outside of the temple, outside of Har HaBayit, like even today, right? Someone who would, you know, if you grew up with a very strict ban on making sure that you don't point to the Zroa at the Seder and say, Pesach, Pesach Zo, She'achlu Avoteinu. If you grew up with a taboo on doing that, that is because of the fear of Shochetu Ma'ale Bachutz. We don't want to, even today with no temple, do anything in the outer precincts of Jewish life, that is to say, anywhere outside of Har HaBayit, that indicates that we might be preparing ourselves or doing, God forbid, any sacrificial act. So that whole chapter is about banning that. And it says, for instance, if you kill an animal in that way, dam yechashev laishahu dam shafach, basically that's an unauthorized killing of an animal, and it's considered an unauthorized taking of animal life, you have spilt its blood. But there is this sort of doubled articulation. Dam yechashev laishahu, that will be considered blood. Dam shafach, he spilled blood. Why do you need to say it again? Rabbi Ishmael used that to say, lirabot et hazorek. That added phrase, dam shafach, means to tell you that not only if you slaughter an animal for purposes of a sacrifice outside of the Temple Mount, are you chayav karet? Have you violated a serious prohibition? Meaning, if you do it purposely, you are cut off. And if you do it without fully understanding what's going on, you'll have to bring a chatat to the temple in Jerusalem, a sacrifice to atone for yourself. But even if you just sprinkled the blood on that external altar, someone else did the sacrificing, someone else burned it up, but you came and sprinkled the blood, you are the zorek, dam shafach, which is language of, right, spilling blood, here understood to be not spilling the blood of the animal, but spilling blood on the altar. That's a reference to the Zorek. The Zorek is also covered by this law, says Rabbi Ishmael. Rabbi Akiva Omer, O Zavach, lirabot et hazorek. In the verse that introduces this prohibition of shchutei chutz, of sacrificing outside, it says, asher ya'ale ola ozavach. Anyone who will ya'ale ola, will cause a burnt offering to go up, which seems like it would be sufficient on its own to cover anything you're going to burn on an altar. But then it says, ozavach, including what in the pshat is including an offering where you will eat the meat, right? An olah is where you burn the meat entirely, and a zevach is where you burn the fat and sprinkle the blood, but you eat the meat. But Rabbi Akiva sees that ozavach as being unnecessary superfluity in the verse, and therefore says, no, that's lirabot et hazorek. Ozavach lirabot et hazorek. So what do we have here? A debate between Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Akiva, both of whom agree that the one who sprinkles blood is covered by the Torah's prohibition on doing something sacrificial outside of the temple, but they disagree whether it comes from dam shafach or it comes from ozavach. And now the Gemara playing that out, v'tarvayu mai kamarbu, And what are they both intending to, right, include? Zrika, sprinkling of the blood. Mar maiti la midam yechashev, mar maiti la me'ozavach. What I just said, they're bringing them from different places. Okay, now we're going to try to undermine this. Ve'ha'amar Rabbi Abahu, shachat v'zarak ika beinayhu. No, but Rabbi Abahu came along and said, this is not just a debate over two ways to derive the same law. There is an actual dispute underneath that exegetical argument, and that is the case of if one person slaughtered the animal and sprinkled its blood, Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Akiva don't think about it the same way. Ledivre Rabbi Ishmael eino chayav ela achat. Ledivre Rabbi Akiva chayav shtayim. According to Rabbi Abahu, Rabbi Ishmael would say that if you slaughter and sprinkle, you're only liable for one violation. It's one karet, it's one chatat. According to Rabbi Akiva, you would be liable for two. Okay, so let's just see Rashi here. I think nicely explains what's happening. Shachat v'zarak, behelem echad. If in one lack of consciousness, in one moment, that is to say, without thinking about it as two separate activities, you do these two activities. Shachat v'zarak. The Rabbi Ishmael, eino chayav ela chatat achat. According to Rabbi Ishmael, you'd only be liable for one sin offering. Why? Demaiti le lizorek mikaret dichtiv b'shochet. Because his derivation of the ban on sprinkling the blood comes from the same verse that says, if you slaughter, you get karet. And it in that verse says, dam shafach. But it's just part of, it's basically under the same rubric. V'cheivan dechad karet, v'chad lav, atarvayu ein chiluk, v'chad lav atarvayu. And since it's one karet and one prohibition that applies to both of those things, ein chiluk chatat b'nehem. There is therefore no basis for dividing the chatat, dividing the sin offering into two, ki avdinu be'ele machat. When, right, provided the circumstances are such that you did them without thinking about them as two separate acts. That's a little bit of sort of, side note there about the question of when you're chayav hachatat. We're not getting into that. The point is, according to Rabbi Ishmael, his derivation pins the liability of the zorek on words that appear in the verse about the shochet, such that if you do them together, they're just two aspects of the same prohibition. Whereas for Rabbi Akiva, the alif zorek mikaret dichtiv ga'abe ma'ale, where Rabbi Akiva anchors it in the verse ozavach, which is not talking about slaughter, but is talking about actually putting the thing up in fire, then havala ho shochet v'zorek shnei kretot v'chayav shtay. Essentially, to sort of simplify it here, according to Rabbi Abahu, which verse or phrase you pick as the origin potentially nests it in a different law, and therefore either considers it to just be a subcategory of that law or a totally different count, as it were, that you can be charged on. Okay? So this would then lead us to say, again, as we've been sort of doing throughout the sugya, this is not ta'am achad mishnei mikraot, this is shnei ta'amim. Okay? Okay, finally we're going to resolve here and get out of trouble, and then we'll say some sort of reviewing and wrapping up sentiments about this. Ha it marala. No. There was a further comment and gloss on this, which can save us from Rabbi Abahu. Hayit marala, amar Abaye, af ledivre Rabbi Akiva nami eino chayav ela achat. Abaye came along and said, no. Rabbi Abahu has it wrong. Actually, even Rabbi Akiva agrees that if you slaughter and sprinkle the blood, you've only violated, they can only get you basically on one count. De amar kra, shamta ale olotecha, visham ta'ase. Arvinu rachmana lechulhu asiyot. Because the verse in Deuteronomy that says, you must offer your burnt offerings there, and that's where you must perform everything, and puts that all in one phrase, Abaye understands that to be the Torah thereby mixes together all the sacrificial actions you might take into one count. And therefore, since there's this other verse properly read as saying, doing, you know, all kinds of different actions that are part of being ma'ale, of offering up the sacrifice, are all one thing. So slaughtering and sprinkling would be considered one, even for him. Not because of his choice of a verse in Vayikra, but because there's this kind of bundling of culpability in Dvarim. Okay, there's a lot of details here on Korbanot. If you like Zvachim stuff and you know all of this, I recommend you can follow up and see where that takes you. For our purposes, right, what's significant and important here is the sugya is trying to give some sort of examples from other places where perhaps we can see an example of two people who we could imagine being on a court ending up with the same answer coming from two different verses. In the end, Rav Ashi is the explanation that the Gemara endorses as viable. His example of this Zorek case of sprinkling is one where they conclude, indeed, Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Akiva agree on what the law is. They just disagree where it comes from. And so putting them on the Sanhedrin for a minute, imagine that there were a capital trial of someone, now it wouldn't really be because it's karet, okay? But just play it out for a minute that it's, right, it's still dinei nefashot and malkot and how that would be play out, we can imagine. But they're in a case where they're basically trying someone for having sprinkled blood on an unauthorized external altar, okay? And they're trying to figure out, is what he did, is sprinkling blood actually something we nail someone for? In other words, we know if he slaughtered, he's liable. We know if he burned up the animal, he's liable. But is he liable for sprinkling the blood? And Rabbi Ishmael raises his hand and say, I vote to convict because the Torah is marbe et hazorek, and I cite it from Dam Shafach. And Rabbi Akiva raises his hand and says, I vote to convict, but it's from Ozebach. According to our sugya, we would need to write down basically their bases of what they say, because we would not be able to actually justify convicting one man based on the cumulative arguments of Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Akiva, because only one of them can be right. Because the Torah cannot actually get to that conclusion by both Dam Shafach and Ozavach. Only one of those can be right. So we can convict, we can count them as one vote, because they are both making a valid argument from the Torah as to why this person should be convicted, but we can't count it as two, because even though there's two judges who are voting that way, the Torah can't possibly be voting twice for this person's conviction based on one piece. All right, that's where the sugya kind of ends. Now, here's the only other thing I want to sort of make as a comment on the larger structure here, which is you may have noticed it's kind of a little unfair what happens to Rav Papa and Rav Zavid. That is to say, the earlier Amoraim, who offered either the Rabban Gamliel, Rabbi Yoshua, Kol HaRa'ui La'ishim, Kol HaRa'ui La'mizbeach debate, that was Rav Zavid, or Rav Papa, who said Rabbi Yose Aglili and Rabbi Akiva are arguing over Kvasim and Ola, right? Well, really? They didn't know that there were people who said there was an argument there? Like they were unaware of the fact that there was a practical dispute there. And how particularly the puzzling thing is, remember, Rav Zvid gets knocked out how? We say, V'ha hata miflag pligi. But there, they argue. And then we introduce Rav Papa, and Rav Papa is knocked out by saying, but wait a minute, according to Rav Ada Bar Ava, who's earlier than Rav Papa, they were arguing in that case. Is Rav Papa not smart enough to know that there was an argument there? So this seems to me like a kind of a case where almost certainly what's happening here is Rav Zvid and Rav Papa probably thought of ta'am echad, not as meaning that they come to the identical, exact same conclusion, but ta'am, right? Not din echad, but ta'am echad mishnei mikraot, and it's the same basic idea, right? They're deriving the same basic idea from a totally different verse. Rav Zvid is like, yeah, this is good enough. Rav Papa might have gotten a little antsy about it because the text Rav Zvid quotes actually continues on to say, but they disagree. But he too is maybe just offering another example. As you saw, these four positions are adjacent to each other in the Sifra. He's probably just like, yeah, this would work too, okay? And it's the Gemara that then, in search of sort of dialectical progression, wants to make there be something wrong with Rav Zvid, something wrong with Rav Papa, in order to culminate in Rav Ashi's argument. It's true, Abaye comes to save the day, you know, anachronistically. He is quoted in order to make Rav Ashi stand. Not clear that like organically had to be there, or that Rav Ashi was actually thinking about that when he quoted his Baraita. So it's one of these things where the Gemara sometimes has basically what might have been at its core, one rabbi saying, hey, I think this, and someone else saying, that's nice, and I've got this one, and a third one saying, great, I'd like to add this one. But the way the whole style of the Gemara works is based on sort of argumentation and later arguments replacing earlier ones. So turning what might have been originally an Amar of Papa and an Amar of Ashi into Ella Amar of Papa and Ella Amar of Ashi makes on some level literarily and rhetorically for a better sugya. But to the extent you feel any discomfort of like, I don't know, I feel like Rav Zvid and Rav Papa got too easily shot down, that may be part of what's going on. A couple of comments here in the chat, and I welcome others. Is it common for the Gemara to assume with these Midrash Halacha questions that you've read the longer version of the Sifra? No, I would not say it is common. But I think if you want to do not just sort of like, hey, Daf Yomi, I'm just trying to get through it, but sort of carefully understand what they're doing it, and in part what I just did, which is to sensitize us to the ways in which an earlier, simpler text is being made a little more complicated in a way to create a more elaborate sugya, I think it's very powerful and indispensable. So that's why I took us through that exercise, but that's important. One other one that was sent to me privately is the principle different from having more than one place in the Torah that asserts citizens must be treated the same under the same law. So yeah, that's interesting with what I began with. In general, that is behind, right, the notion, what I said at the beginning, that the Torah says in more than one place, Mishpat Echad Yihyeh Lachem, this principle, that Ein Ta'am Echad Yotzei Mishnei Mikraot, is what leads the whole Midrashic enterprise to look for further layers of meaning in otherwise seemingly redundant texts, right? So the whole point is, it can't be the Torah would just say, Mishpat Echad Yihyeh Lachem twice in order to underline the point, because the Torah doesn't do that. God doesn't waste words in that way, as it were. But what the Torah will do is potentially say something twice, intending you to uncover some deeper meaning out of it, and there being some other dimension. And that's where in our chapter, they're basically like, oh, so Mishpat Echad Yihyeh Lachem, one of them must be, civil and criminal procedure must be basically the same. That's where that comes from. Okay, great. All right, good. And we have some follow-up there. Just to get to the question, if you were looking at the Rashi here, yeah, there's some other things when they're imagining some of the things that you might have allowed up on the Mizbeach, Ben Shenireh, Ben Shelo Nireh, He gives some examples of things that are just like wildly inappropriate for the Mizbeach, and therefore, even if they go up there by mistake, they come down, like seor, basically leaven, chametz, which is never supposed to go on the Mizbeach, dvash, honey, ki chol seor uchol dvash, lo taktiru mimenu ishel Hashem, says the Torah. Or ayal and tzvi, which are two of the animals that are listed in Dvarim as permissible for eating, but they are chayot, they are not domesticated animals, and a chaya never is offered on the Mizbeach. What if someone brought some deer meat up to the Mizbeach that was designated as an olah? And chulin, right, something that was never consecrated in the first place, that's just mundane meat. Those are all things that we're imagining we're shooting down as we deal with this. So as I said, this is sort of an interesting entree into, and I think so much of Kodashim, like we're not doing Kodashim here, but I'm learning Kodashim now with my 10-year-old in Mishnah. And it's an amazing Seder for getting at all kinds of sort of implicit, larger values questions. This is no exception, kind of questions of when do you tolerate errors and let them slide, and when do you say, no, we need a do-over on this. This is not okay. And in particular, this has been sort of at times fruitful material for thinking about how we do that in shul. Like, what things in the public prayer service might you say about them? Oh, that shouldn't have happened that way, but we're just going to let that go. And what context do we say, no, that has to be done over? And in an even more intense way, thinking of the shulchan, the amud, the, you know, sort of the space where the main ritual work happens in shul, as the mizbeach, and potentially thinking about the olot, the things that are going up to it to be offered, as being, for instance, people who get an aliyah, some of this discourse is then actually repurposed by some poskim to think about in what situations where someone inappropriately got an aliyah, do you say, we can't actually allow this to go forward? And in what cases do you say, well, it shouldn't have happened that way, but whatever, it's fine. And there's a kind of amazing text by the Chasdei David, Rav David Pardo, who's writing in the 1700s, 1800s, I'm blanking now, but in one of those centuries, I think 1700s, where he is actually, he's commenting on the passage in Tosefta Megillah that says that, well, technically women can have an aliyah to the Torah, but the sages said that they shouldn't because of considerations of honor in the community. Many folks know I've written about this at great length, as other people have, but for these purposes, what's fascinating is the Chasdei David says, v'im alta lo tered, borrowing the language from this discussion, basically, it's true, aliyot are supposed to be gendered, you know, in the world that he's experiencing and seeing and assessing. But if a woman ended up being called up to the Torah, then she doesn't go down. Because at the end of the day, the text he's commenting on says, fundamentally, aliyot are a gender blind enterprise. It's just there was sort of a later phase of feeling that it was not appropriate, and in fascinating ways that gets quoted by certain people in the 20th century who are trying to justify and move towards greater gender egalitarianism in Torah reading by saying, well, we have this notion of imaltalo tered, and it's parallel to korbanot, and so maybe in a situation where it feels like we're already in a different, you know, environment, we should perhaps allow and tolerate things that we might not otherwise have sort of planned in other contexts. Obviously, in many environments, we have moved way beyond that in terms of a much more affirmative gender equality in those spaces. But it's a great example of how sometimes these phrases and these debates end up being the basis of things that are much more practical and much more connected to all kinds of things. Great. Yeah, Masha Asa Sui, exactly, which is a whole other realm and comes up particularly in sort of Choshen Mishpat and other kind of monetary law things of when is that done. Third Perek of Kiddushin is a great, great place where that kind of stuff comes up. Good. Yeah, Ma'alim Bakodesh Velo Moridin, someone else chatted about that. That has some similarity. That phrase tends to be a little more about how I organize things and how I sort of set them up. But there are contexts where that's the case, where someone's sort of been elevated or promoted in a certain way and it's inappropriate to take them down. This is more forceful than that, in that this is really taking something that is pasul, like it's really forbidden to bring this on the Mizbeach, but the Mizbeach sanctity gets the better of the thing and of the situation. And that's what's partially kind of amazing about it. Good. Okay. I don't think we're going to charge full on into the next sugya, because I think it makes sense to begin that next time when we have more than only 9 minutes were we to start it. I'll just give sort of the preview of where it's going here, which is we're now going to move on, as we have been, to the next comparison between Dinei Mamonot and Dinei Nefashot. And in particular, we're going to start out with the Mishnah's articulation. Dinei Mamonot, I'm just picking it up from the Mishnah here, Dinei Mamonot, Danin Bayom V'Gomrim Balayla. How do we know that civil cases have to be begun during the day, but you are allowed to conclude them during the nighttime hours? And we're going to basically do a whole derivation of that and play through sort of different models and different things in the Torah that might speak to, in one way or another, why time of day is important or significant. That's something you can think about as kind of homework for next time. What, if anything, in the Torah in different areas of law potentially indicates that various ritual or judicial or other functions, you know, should happen at a certain point in time. And that's where we'll go to next time. Any comments or questions or thoughts on reflections on anything we've done tonight, this evening? I'm happy for any final thoughts on this sort of really second order, but I think kind of fascinating reflection on how pregnant with meaning is the Torah.
Yeah, I just wanted, isn't, maybe you addressed this, but isn't the fundamental way that we learn, that we derive that Mikra Echad Yotze, the Kamet Ta'amim, the Ein, you know, Shemik wrote, Tam Echad, derived from two verses?
Yeah, I mean, I think you mentioned this last time as well. I think there's something very beautiful and playful about it. You know, the in our sugya, on some level, there's no problem with that happening, right? That is to say, there's no problem with two different people coming up with two different derivations for arriving at the same point in time. We just are asked to acknowledge that that must be a fundamental machloket, right? That is to say, they can't both be right. Or more to the point, maybe they can each be right in their parallel universe, but the idea is one person cannot simultaneously hold both of those exegetical truths. That just can't be. And so when the court is convicting, it therefore is acting as one. It is acting, as it were, as a person that has to sort of have a coherent reading of Torah behind it. And you can't multiple count the votes there. So, I mean, that's where I think, so it's not that they can't exist on the page, right? Because Devei Rabbi Yishmael and who is it, Abaye, they both exist there as two ways of getting at that principle, but you couldn't simultaneously hold both of those.
Unless you say that it's really talking about more Torah versus teaching laws. And this is more of almost like a meta principle. So you can't have two verses of the Torah teaching the same law, as opposed to two Pesukim and Tanakh teaching the meta principle.
Right. So good. So this really goes to, I think, what I was toying with, which is what is the meaning of ta'am in our sugya? Right. So our sugya definitely moves to a direction where it moves it to din in some way. And then that really opens up retrospectively even further your suggestion that, yeah, so once it's really about din, well, then you can have a sort of agadic principle, meta principle, exegetical principle come from multiple places because it's not a law. I'm not sure Rav Zvid and Rav Papa saw it that way, which then makes it potentially a sort of delicious moment of, you know, the sugya doing its own ironic take on that. But I think, that's a great way of reflecting on that. Great. Just one more thing. Yoel, I saw you had a question on how different is this from U.S. jurisprudence. Which specific point are you asking?
The notion that judges who agree on the overall legal result, that you don't count both votes unless they agree on the specific legal principle involved. Perhaps I'm thinking, at least it strikes me at first thought as not consistent with the U.S. system. I mean, I'm thinking of the Supreme Court where all the time we have splintered majorities with, you know, a plurality saying X and another group saying X, but for different reasons, and then X wins.
Right. There's others more expert on the call than me, but my understanding is that, which is to say, yes, if you've got a sort of a 5-4 vote, but there's a 3-2 in the 5 of two totally different reasons, that is a sort of less controlling opinion in certain ways. But there's other folks who know more about that than I.
No, but my point is that they're each counted as one vote. You don't say, oh, at this point, this doesn't win because they only got it. That's my point, yeah.
Yeah, right. No, so for sure it's different. I think the question is, how much of an echo might we say there is in, yeah, it counts for deciding that case, but in terms of sort of establishing precedent and direction, they do get counted sort of as half votes, you know, in some way. Mm-hmm. Jerry, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just curious, going back to what you and Professor Kaplan were talking about, where else is this principle used, sort of how Halama said? Because, you know, it seems to me that what's driving in it, or one way of understanding the sugya, picking up on what you were talking about before, is that the court in some way acts as one, or you know, it's kind of like we don't want anybody convicted unless it's a really, really, you know, we're going to do everything to prevent that conviction, so to speak. And so I'm just curious if this principle is used sort of halakha ma'aseh elsewhere.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can give you a, you know, meaningfully accurate and comprehensive answer on that. I feel like the main place it plays out is sort of in the whole fabric of Midrash Halakha, right? That is to say, so there may be other places where it comes up. I'd have to look into it, where in a very practical way, it's like, oh, because of that, you know, you're counting them as one vote. But it's sort of like the engine of the whole system of looking for meaning, right?
Right, which is not necessarily practical, right?
Correct, that's right.
That's kind of the distinction I'm trying to point.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, is it for arguments for acquittal as opposed to conviction? It brings it up as the reason you would write down the acquitting. I think that actually someone asked this last time, which is, but once you get to sort of, you know, where we've got to at the end, couldn't this shouldn't this also be an argument on the other side? And my answer was basically like, I think that's right. I didn't find someone who articulated that, but I think that's right. It's like, we didn't start with that. But once we get to this, this would seem to be a principle that would go in both directions. So, right. So given that, you're right, though, it's brought up in that context. So if you're responding to Jerry's suggestion of maybe we're only bringing it up here because we have a tendentious desire, right, to get people off. I think you're right that that doesn't seem to be the overwhelming agenda driver here. In that sense, sort of the nature of the Torah feels actually much more central here than a desired procedural outcome. Yeah, so thanks for pointing that out. All right, I want to respect folks' time. There's more we can say. Great to be back with everyone. Looking forward to next week, same time, 8 p.m., and we'll start a brand new sugya. So looking forward to that.